You don't feel like the melodic songs don't belong. You don't feel like the personal songs don't belong. You know, they wrap it all together so well.
Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. We talk about our favorite records. Talking Records Podcast. We're so glad you tuned in. Thank you all for listening. You showed up to the right place. Jed and his friends dive deep and analyze the records we have grown to love. We'll tell you how we found the band, then give you a track-by-track breakdown of all the songs. So grab your favorite beverage and pull up a seat. Today we'll look at another record in its entirety.
Hello, what's up, everyone? My name is Jed, and you're listening to Talking Records, a podcast. I'm just a really big fan of all kinds of music, and I love knowing the details and the behind-the-scenes stories of my favorite albums. My goal here is to round up everything I can on a particular album and put it all in one place, for you, so you don't have to. I ask friends to join me in breaking down these great records, and today I'm joined by Sammy Warmhands. How's it going, Sammy?
Good, man. I feel like I'm listening to the show. Like if I just avert my eyes from the screen, it's like I'm just tuning into another episode.
I've got that introduction down pat.
Well, and the other thing is like, you know, when we listen to each other from audio or we know each other sort of social media, you don't really know what the other person looks like.
Yeah.
And right now you've got the pop screen over your face. So I still don't fully know what you look like. And I think that's amusing.
I like to hide behind it.
Yeah.
Be mysterious. Every once in a while I'll come out.
It's good though. It keeps the whole mystique intact.
Yeah. You know, it's a podcast. People can't see me, so neither can you.
Yeah. Fair.
All right, Sammy. So speaking of podcasts, you also have a great podcast, the Take 92 podcast. Tell us a little bit about your show.
Yeah, I started in 2015 and it was sort of, I felt like then I was late to the game and now I feel like I got in at a good time. Yeah. But at the time, you know, it was sort of a way I would bring on a different friend of mine from, you know, people I've known through playing music for 25 years and just kind of bullshit about records. And then eventually it sort of became like, well, tell me more about your story and how you started. And then eventually that turned into getting guests that maybe I had opened for or something. And then that went to guests that I had never even met, but always looked up to. And so it's just kind of become this big thing. And it's like, you know, by the time we were in like our fifth season, you know, I'm interviewing like Lou from Sick of It All and Jello Biafra and like, yeah. Oh my God, I can't believe it, you know? And it's just been amazing. And we're about to air our 100th episode in July with Daryl McDaniels from DMC. And it's just been it's taken on this whole life of its own. And in 2019, I started another podcast called the Bat Fanatic Podcast, spelled Bat Fan Addict, where my friends and I, who have always played music together, we also love comics.
Nice.
And so we review Batman comics and films and animation and all that.
Oh,
and
wow.
We've completed two full seasons of that.
I'll have to check that out. I'm a big Batman fan myself, so.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
If you look around, this is like all my original sketches and autographs.
I was admiring your bat wall.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got like every bat actor up there, autographs and all these originals. I'm going to another Comic-Con next week.
Nice.
So yeah, that's a huge, huge part of my life is,
look at that
Batman. So
very cool.
It's been really fun. And it was a great way, as you know, when everything was locked down and no one was seeing each other, to still feel like I was getting to hang out with my friends every week, because we would get to, do our little group Zooms and then I would get to go do an interview with somebody about music. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it was enough, you know. I'm pretty good at being a hermit in the studio, and so just to have those little things was plenty.
Yeah, it was huge, man. This podcast for me was a savior, because not being able to see friends and talk to friends on the regular, this podcast, you know, swooped in and took care of that for me. You know, talking to people about music every week and just seeing people's faces, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I love this show, man. I like I told you, I think I've listened to about 40 or 50 episodes, because I listen to each one that I actually own and know the record you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it's just been a blast, because, you know, it feels like hanging out with your friends growing up, you know, because it's like, oh, well, when did you hear? Oh, man, back in high school, I went to this show. And I'm like, oh, I went to that tour, you know. And
that's great.
So it's been really fun to listen to it. And yeah, I'm glad to be part of it.
Nice. In addition to your podcast, you have a band, Dead Fucking Serious, and you've got new music out.
Yes. We have a brand new album coming out called Clandemic. It was produced by myself and Paul Miner from Death by Stereo. He did all the mixing, mastering, and all the stuff on it in post, and it sounds amazing. And it's like my favorite punk album I've ever made. And, you know, I mentioned Lou from Sick of It All. He actually does a guest appearance. And so does Ephraim from Death by Stereo. And their drummer, Mike Canberra, plays on the whole album. And it was just a blessing in so many ways. And if anyone's like a punk rock fan, you're listening to this show, and you'll recognize the Dead Kennedys and God We Trust. And the artist from that, Winston Smith, has done all of our records for a few years now. And I got him to remake that cover in sort of a modern twist on it that I thought up. And so it's just on every level, this is like my favorite record, you know. It's just so exciting. And worked on it for the last 2+ years, and finally here.
Yeah, that's great. It feels good to have, you know, a project like that finally see the light of day. You know, you've been working on it so long, consumed by it, and then it's out.
I mean, the big thing with this one is, because I generally work pretty fast, but I wrote all of this in 2020, and it's just all of that anxiety and this feeling of like the world collapsing around you, and yet I could demo the bass and the guitar and the vocals, but I couldn't get with another person to actually record the song. So that's why it's taken so long to get it out. But like, yeah, I've had these finished ideas for so long. It's just, it's amazing to finally like have it in my hand, you know, like I can hold it and just look at it. And even just that is, it's like, okay, this is finally real.
That's great. Well, congratulations. Where can people find it?
If you go to take92.com, that'll link you to my Bandcamp, and you know, you can get the CD, the T-shirt. We got skate decks made for the first time in a limited quantity.
That's rad.
With the Winston Smith artwork, and it's super cool. And then yeah, we're playing that day in Portland, Oregon, with the Wilhelm Scream, and we're playing in Eugene, Oregon, on June 30th with Negative Approach. So
a couple
big release shows, and then we'll go back and work on the next one.
Hey everyone, I just wanted to take a minute to direct your attention towards our Instagram at Talking Records Podcast. We can also be found on Twitter and YouTube. Give us a like or a follow and join in the chatter about favorite records and songs. We're music lovers and collectors and love nothing more than to chat music. Come say hello. You can also visit our website at talkingrecordspodcast.com. There you will find episodes, merch, and more. You can even drop us an email at talkingrecords@outlook.com. These are all great ways for us to connect with you over all the great music we enjoy. We would love to get this podcast into more ears, and you can help by providing us with a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as every review helps us reach more listeners. Also, word of mouth is helpful too. All right, thanks everyone. Today, Sammy Warmhands and I will be talking about Rise Against's Revolutions Per Minute. Revolutions Per Minute was released on April 8th, 2003 on Fat Records. The album was produced by Bill Stevenson and Jason Livermore at the Blasting Room in Fort Collins, Colorado, the previous fall winter. The band even spent Thanksgiving at Bill's house. In preparation for the album, bassist Joe Principal told Reply Alt's Rank Your Records, "We were rehearsing 3-4 days a week. No kids. We just had nothing but time. Rehearsing above an old roach-infested antique store." Despite that, though, the band maintains that the preparation was fun and felt like the first real collaboration as a band. The band joined Matt Allison at Atlas Studios in Chicago, to record demos. As the songs took shape, Fat Wreck head Fat Mike noticed. Joe told Reply Alt, "I remember Fat Mike said, 'Thank God these demos are amazing because the second record lets me know if a band is going to break up and fall apart quickly or if they're going to thrive.' And I can tell you guys are going to thrive." So that's pretty cool.
That's great. Yeah.
The band then tried to enlist a producer for the record, but had two flake out on them. I'm not sure why they didn't just stick with Matt Allison.
Yeah, I actually just read in the book Sellout by Dan Ozzie.
Yeah.
That the band's first choice was Brian McTernan, who had done like Thrice and Strike Anywhere. And their second choice was Ryan Green. And he was also just booked up with all the other Fat bands. And
yeah, he's a busy guy. Thought,
how crazy that this lifelong friendship that they've had with Bill and Jason,
yeah,
at the Blasting Room almost didn't happen.
It's fate, man.
You know, how, and that record being such a turning point for the Blasting Room itself. You know, I've had both Bill and Jason on my show and talked about how, you know, that record was one of the first times I went, "Ooh, these guys are really doing something different."
And yeah,
they were like, "Yeah, same here." You know, like, yeah, that's when we finally started to get the secret sauce, you know?
Yeah, that's amazing. And I love to like think about that, like what little thing had to happen in order for all this to happen, you know? And that's it. It was just two producers, not one, two producers didn't work out. And then they got to Bill and Jason. So I think that's amazing. You know, the Blasting Room is so amazing. They do so many, they've done so many great albums there. And this is one of them.
I'm a big production guy. You know, I produced a lot of records in my life, like a disgusting amount. and I've always obsessed over the sonic qualities of records, you know, to the extent that when I was getting into punk rock, it's like, ooh, like Pennywise, NOFX, and I'm hearing these things for the first time, and then somebody would be like, "Oh, check out the Misfits," and I'm like, "This is terrible." And they'd be like, "Oh, check out Bad Religion," and it'd be something from How Could Hell Be Any Worse, yeah, or 80-85 or something. And I'd be like, "Oh, this is terrible," right? And then I couldn't understand it until I got the sonics of it. You know, I'd be the kind of guy that obsesses over amps and mic placement, and you know, I used to change out the pickups and the strings and all the stuff on all my guitars. And so from a young age, like watching the development of the Blasting Room from like Operation Phoenix, Good Riddance, kind of through Rise Against and Wilhelm Scream and some of these other bands, you know, I've been very invested in what they do, and their relationship with Rise Against is maybe the best example of that evolution.
I'm working with Bill. Vocalist Tim told Ultimate Guitar, "We had a couple producers fall through on us and we needed to do this record and we only had 30 days to do it. Someone mentioned Bill's name and he had a pretty high profile in the punk world. He had done some Good Riddance records and a bunch of Fat Wreck records, and obviously he was Bill Stevenson, the drummer from Black Flag and the drummer and songwriter in The Descendants. We were a band that was having a little bit of an identity crisis. We were meeting our musical soulmate in the person and the person who would understand the nuances of Rise Against. Our sounds, and he would understand intimately my voice and the lyrics and the kind of message. He tapped into it, and he got it." According to Bill Stevenson, Rise Against is what I would call a real band, in every sense. Close friends with their own shared sense of humor and identity, making music for the sake of music, not to get popular. Bill was also excited about the demos he heard. Moved by the band's sense of conviction and purpose, Bill said, "As the recording unfolded over the next weeks, I was being reintroduced to how great punk rock can be." Pretty nice endorsement from Bill Stevenson.
Yeah, when I asked Bill about them, he was just like, "Oh, I love those guys so much. You know, they're my best friends." And you know, I think that they sell themselves short a little bit when you read back that quote from Tim, where he said they had done Good Riddance and, quote, a lot of other Fat records. And that wasn't really true, because at the time, 2003, Ryan Green is still king shit.
He's head honcho, yeah,
in punk producing world. And so it wasn't until after RPM that NOFX and No Use and Lagwagon all went over there. At the time, Good Riddance was the first band to jump ship. And as far as I know, Rise Against was the second, or, you know, what they were really, really high on that list in terms of bands that were willing to give those guys a shot. And I think it sort of made the careers of both of them in a way.
Wow. Yeah.
I both agree. Found that sound. You know, if you listen to the Unraveling versus the remixed Unraveling versus RPM, it's like, yeah, they found that sound together, you know.
This would be the band's first album to feature Todd, vocalist Tim McGrath's roommate and former bandmate. Tim would also play guitar on this album, something he did not do on the band's debut, The Unraveling. Chad Price from All Drag the River sang backup vocals on this album. Kind of hard to hear him, but he's in there somewhere.
Yeah, I never knew that until fairly recently, and then it's like you listen back and I still can't really
tell Tim. The way yeah.
mixed, you know?
Yeah. The band would work all day and then spend their nights wandering Fort Collins, or setting up a four-track in the studio to record joke songs as Poisonous Poison. At some point, Journey came on the radio, and the band joked about how they should cover the song, since no one ever recognized the Minor Threat cover they had been doing.
I thought that was awesome. I just asked Jason the other day, I said, hey, I'm going on Talking Records, and when they talk about RPM, is there anything that people really just wouldn't know from those sessions? And he said, yeah, well, there was a hilarious side project we would record at night after the sessions called Poisonously Poison, and it has never seen the light of day. And I was like,
I'd love to hear it.
Please tell me more. And he was just like, you're not going to hear it. I'm not going to say anything.
According to guitarist Todd, throughout the session, we learned a great deal and grew as musicians, became a part of the Fort Collins family, and had an absolute blast. Joe said this was a huge turning point for us and set the bar high for future Rise Against records. So, Sammy, I want to know, how did you get into this record?
I actually remember getting into this band very clearly. First of all, there was that one fat comp, Live Fat, Die Young.
Yeah.
It came out in March 2001, which was a month before The Unraveling came out. And it had the song Join the Ranks. Mm-hmm. And it was like a shitty demo recording. And I later found out it was the first thing they ever recorded. It was sort of like Tim's audition to the band. Like, hey, you sing on this and see how it sounds. And they're like, oh, shit. Like, if you read the liner notes for the B-sides record, they talk about it in there. So we were blown away by that song and bought The Unraveling. And that same summer, like back to back, The Unraveling and then Strike Anywhere's Changes of Sound, they both came out. And for me and my friends, you know, my high school band that we had been playing together for a few years, it was a game changer because these songs are faster, they're more aggressive vocally, but they're still singable, you know, and there was just an added intensity and a grit about it. And like the drumming, you know, everyone talks about like Eric Sandin from NoFX, you know, he kind of was the high water mark for punk drumming, right? In that style. Brandon Barnes, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, he's not the first name you would think of, but if you listen to those first two records, just the tempo and that snap on his, like his kick in the snare, it's just so powerful. And it's some of my favorite punk drumming anywhere. And you know, you listen to that first record and, you know, RPM really being the turning point because Tim's voice was very clean or full on screaming.
Yeah.
You know, hadn't quite gotten there yet. And, you know, once they did a bunch of touring and he sort of got that gravel in his voice, you know, they never sounded like that again. But those first two records that I heard of being kind of pushing past the Good Riddance and some of the other stuff that I heard were just a massive introduction to like melodic hardcore to me, Rise Against and Strike Anywhere. So yeah, when RPM came out, it was hotly anticipated by me and my friends. You know, it's the kind of thing you go out and buy first day. And I just remember, you know, as we're going to talk about here in the first song, it just hits you like right away.
Yeah.
You know, there's no belabored intro, there's no build up, it's just fucking
boom.
Bam.
Yeah.
Right there. And you know, that's the way the first record was. It was very fast, very short, but it's clear like immediately the melody and the vocal performance and the arrangement. Yeah. And, you know, just kind of as that first song unfolds, you're like, oh, this is something else entirely.
Yeah, they made a huge jump. Yeah.
Yeah. It was just, that was like the record of the year for us, probably. I mean, that and like Artist in the Ambulance, I think, as far as like 2003 albums just being massively influential on what my band was doing. And, you know, going from, you know, Offspring Pennywise style guitar riffs to, you know, a little more hardcore influence and playing with stuff like that in our own music. That's, I think it was Matt from RX Bandits was saying like, dude, that's the greatest compliment is like, not, oh, I wanted to learn how to play your riff or I needed to cover your song or something like that. But like hearing that made me think about playing music differently, you know, and that's what Rise Against did for us.
For me, The Unraveling turned up at the radio station where I worked in college. Back then, anything with the Fat logo on it was worth checking out and most likely going to be awesome. I mean, let's be honest. The first song was explosive and the vocalist had a unique sounding voice. Then my band, No Intention, we talked about them earlier, had the chance to open for Rise Against in Boston. When we got to the show, we were told Rise Against wouldn't be playing. They had kicked out their guitar player, and well, at least that's what they told us, and they weren't going to make it. So Jericho, who later became Smoker Fire, headlined instead. And it was still a good show, but damn, the thing that almost was, you know, opening for Rise Against in the early stages
that's
of our
crazy
bandom would have been pretty amazing. When Revolutions Per Minute came out, I immediately noticed how much better it sounded. The Unraveling was a little quiet and flat compared to the dynamics of this album. This album sounded great, and the songs really stood out. I mean, I was like glued to the lyrics, trying to learn how to write music with an important statement without it coming across as like a history lesson, you know? So like you, I just kind of like looked at this band as a model, as a template, you know, for my own songwriting. The early 2000s were the first time I really got into world affairs and how decisions made at the federal level could affect my life. I had always been mindful of the news and my parents had, you know, taught me to pay attention, but the 2000 election had really pissed me off, like a lot of people. As a voter for the first time, I felt disappointed in the options and I felt very cheated by the results. So here was this band basically saying all the things that I was feeling in a way that I just couldn't.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good observation because I wasn't thinking about thematically. You know, like I said, I kind of get obsessed with the Sonics, but you're right. You know, that being like we went into the Iraq war in March 2003. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember, you know, putting up protest flyers all over our school and like, you know, leading a march and writing protest songs and putting, you know, like spray painting the front of my amp, you know, and like, you know, really getting into politics at that time and what music and politics could do together, you know, part of that melodic hardcore thing with Strike Anywhere, with Rise Against, with Good Riddance, you know, all of those bands having that quality, that was a huge influence too.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, hey, let's dive into these tracks.
Yeah.
All right. The record kicks off with Black Masks and Gasoline. Tim told Alternative Press, as we were writing our songs, the actual song title is often the last touch, not the first. When Joe, bassist, brought the riff for Black Masks and Gasoline into the rehearsal spot, we all thought it had a NoFX feel, so the song was called NoFX.
Nice.
I mean, it's certainly fast as hell and just starts with that one guitar, and then it's basically built off of that.
Yeah, I mean, this song, it has those big crashes, those big guitar blasts in the beginning, and kind of the you know, and sort of builds the tension and then completely drops out to that just guitar and vocal. And that was so ingrained in me as I was listening back critically and taking my notes for this. I was realizing, you know, the first Dead Fucking Serious song that I wrote, the first track on our first EP in 2006, starts the same way.
Oh yeah.
It's with more of like a kind of Sick of It All like thing that just goes a couple bars, but then it drops out to just guitar and vocals and then kicks into that fucking verse. I'm like,
because it's so awesome.
I totally did ape the structure of that like so many years ago. But yeah, like the way that that song builds again, like you're very aware immediately with the arrangement, like, oh, this band is trying something different, you know, because like the snare roll kicks in and he's belting out the vocals and the chorus, like they're known for anthemic hooky choruses, but they weren't at that time. And this is kind of our first taste of that.
Yeah.
You know, and my favorite part, I think, is when we have the bass break, kind of the bridge of the song.
It's like fuzzy. Like,
I have an American dream. Yeah. But like that whole thing.
But it involves black masks and gasoline.
Yeah. That's the title of the song. But like just that little break where the band's ringing out and Joe is laying into that distorted bass line. You know, it was that moment that he became one of my absolute favorite bass players.
Yeah.
Just like the aggression, the tone, the melodic sensibility, you know. The only other thing I'll say about that part is that sometimes lyrically, you ever notice people do like something weird to fit the number of syllables in their melody? Like he says, a world that turned its back down on me. Like turns its back down on you? That's doesn't make sense. Looks down on you.
Yeah.
Turns its back on you.
Turned its back
Which
down
one
on
was
me.
It? I always thought that was weird, but still my favorite part of the song.
Yeah.
And I have the t-shirt from this song too, from when I saw them.
Oh, nice. It's a great song. It's about pushing past what society deems as normal or regular. This idea of how things should be is so ingrained in people's minds. You know, traditions, trends, all the stuff. In the song, the band encourages us to take action and change perceptions. And of course, that's where that great line comes in, you know, and I have an American dream. But yeah, I mean, we have the potential to make change, even if those changes have to start on a smaller scale. But some people give up, you know, like, what can I do? I can't do anything. I'm just me. I'm just this little person, you know. But they're advocating for, no, you can. You can do a lot. You can do a lot to change.
And that's something that's present currently. You know, when you describe the theme of this song, you could apply that to the opening song on the newest album, to apply that to Nowhere Generation. And it's the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
We're not the names that we've been given. We speak a language you don't know. You know, we are the Nowhere Generation. You know, like, we're not going to live in the shadow of those who came before us. You know, we're going to live in the way that's best for us. And
Rejecting tradition, you know, for tradition's sake. That's the thing that always drives me crazy. You know, I love a society that is continuously examining its surroundings, you know, questioning, why are we doing this? Why is it this way? Hey, isn't it about time to change this? You know, you know, maybe accepting difference. The differences, you know, in people are what make us interesting. And I've never understood why so many want to squash that. All right, the next song on the album is Heaven Knows. This is one of the first songs Tim brought in to collaborate on with the band. And I absolutely love this song. You know, the way it alternates between the palm mutes and then the open chords. It's just a great, great, great song. I love how it's set up.
Yeah, and in terms of sequencing, which is something I really appreciate or really have kind of a bone to pick with, in terms of sequencing, it's great because you come out of a fast song with a ripping fast intro, the full band playing that riff, and then they slow down for the whole rest of the song. So it's almost a bait and switch of like, yep, we're keeping up the energy. And then they drop back out to guitar again, but it's in this very like, you know, I've heard Fat Mike talk about it on like later NoFX records, like, yeah, you know, I did a different strum pattern that I don't think I've heard anyone do. And like, think about the palm mute pattern in this.
Yeah.
It's very unique.
Yeah.
And it's sort of slows everything down, and
the last song is like that
now
too.
You're paying attention to the vocals,
yeah,
like now you're listening to everything he's saying, and it really lets the, you know, like the day I learned to fly, I'm never coming down, like that whole thing is so singable that you're just like locked in with Tim. And so I love that it sort of tricks you into the circle pit, and then and now that I have your attention.
Yeah. By the way. Yeah, and like the first song, it has that bass, you know, that bass part toward the end, the distorted bass, and you know, the song slows down but picks up speed over the course of the outro, but never quite goes back up to full speed like at the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, every song on this record is so infectious and singable.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like this is like the second track of an album is so important to me. Like one of my favorite records of all time is Check Your Head, Beastie Boys.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They start with a, you know, boom bap rap song. And then like track two is when you're completely switching it up. Or like Ill Communication, they throw in a hardcore punk song.
Yeah.
Tough guy.
You know, and I think that's important because you're letting people know what you're getting into.
Yeah.
And so with this, they keep it fast, but they do slow it down. They do build more around the vocal melody, and they're kind of letting you know, hey guys, this is gonna be a more melodic record. You know?
Yeah. This song draws upon that image of souls rising up to heaven. Someone has died, either by their own hand or some other way. Tim sings, "The day I learn to fly, I'm never coming down. On perfect wings, I'll rise through the layers of the clouds. Going up to heaven, but then looking down to see many who have managed to survive or stay alive. And from there, I see the neon grids of cities and 6 million people that keep their fires lit."
And the way that's delivered is very, like, you wouldn't hear that. You might hear this type of song sort of on a later Rise Against record, but they would have never done like the hardcore group shout thing in the chorus, you know?
Yeah.
Like there's still, like they were saying, it's kind of a growth period, you know?
Mm.
And you're hearing the band that they're going to turn into by like Sufferer and The Witness in some moments, but you're still hearing the band from The Unraveling.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
I think that's why this is such a favorite for me, is that it's kind of just the best of everything that they offer through their career.
Yeah. All right, Dead Ringer. Fast and loud, right out of the gate.
Yeah. Just ripping hardcore.
This one goes on all my jogging mixes.
I can see why. Like the intensity in those verses is, again, like if you were to get a more recent Rise Against record, that full on screaming that he's doing is something that you might hear on like a bridge at like the climax of the song or something, like
the apex,
you know. He doesn't do it quite as much, and for this is just like the song is built on it. Like we're just going to do a hardcore song, and you know they let you sing a little bit in the chorus, and it's still really catchy. But like, man, it just goes for the throat.
And it's such a powerful song, and I love the lyrics to this one because you know it talks about how people don't always agree with the politics or beliefs of their families, and this song makes me think of a person who has kind of been cut off or kicked out of their home for having a different view on things. I mean, I don't know if that's exactly what the song's about, but that's the vibe I get. He sings, "The place I call home isn't there anymore. And then once you held a place for me, but now that I've left, you went and gave up my seat." And then, of course, "Don't expect me to share your visions of life." So all that kind of together, you know, gives me that sense.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why it's called Dead Ringer, though. A dead ringer is something that looks like something else. So maybe he's comparing the problems of his household to the problems of the country. I don't know.
I wasn't thinking of that like a ringer. I was thinking it more of like in terms of a phone, like, you know, like dead air, like dial tone, like no one's listening sort of.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, just a great song about, you know, having a different view, having differences. We were talking about differences earlier. You know, people tend to let their differences create walls between each other. And I think that's really unfortunate. I mean, I said that before. We're such a polarized society where people get stuck in what's right and what's wrong. And I just think that that's due to generations of conditioning. You know, growing up watching Good versus Evil.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, you're wrong about that. And I don't want to talk to you anymore. So,
No, I'm right.
Actually, it's funny. Like when I listen to this show, there's almost nothing that I disagree on. You know, like, you guys do such a deep dive and have such an understanding of the records. It's like, man, they really just obsessed over this shit like I did. It's great.
A little too much. You know, it's a passion.
It's good.
Yeah. The next song on the album, track 4, Halfway There.
This is a perfect Rise Against song.
Yeah, this is the one that starts with like a bunch of questions.
Yes, like the way that the song is written is beautifully executed. Like, whether it's, you know, you're talking a lot about lyrics, I'm talking a lot about arrangement, and this is the song where they perfectly match each other, right? You know, it's one giant buildup. We have two intros. We have two halves of the first verse. Like, it starts out and he's like, singing softly, you know, like, is this the point where we, you know, and then the second half of the same verse, there's no break, there's no nothing. It's like, sort of, you know, he's got this vulnerable side of like, oh man, I feel like giving up, you know, I can't do this anymore. And then this sort of like, sit up in your seat, like, or is this the time to ask questions?
And then they start making statements, whatever.
Yeah, man.
This is the point where we stand up. This is the point where we take back. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. And like, dude, when we explode into that chorus, you know, when in doubt, like, that's like a minute long buildup into the song of like, every step of the way is leading to this big payoff. And oh my God, it is perfect.
Yeah. It's why this album's so great.
Yeah.
Deciding something needs to change is the first step, right? You're halfway there when you admit a problem or decide something needs to change.
Well, and the way that you had said, you know, like, this is the time, this is the point, you know, he doesn't do that until the later verse. And so when in the beginning, it's like all these introspective questions, and then it's like these kind of big societal questions. And then it's the statement of like, after that, enough is enough, and we're halfway there. Okay, now it's like, game plan, motherfucker. Let's do something here. And like, what? How could you better distill like the ethos of this band into one song? Mm. You know, it's just, it's perfect.
Yeah.
And to bury it like kind of, you know, 4 songs in too.
Mm. Yeah, good point. The next song is Like the Angel. Tim told AP, we call this one Lifetime for obvious reasons when you hear the opening bass line. And we were fans of everything from Lifetime to Bad Brains, and we weren't afraid to write pop songs, hardcore songs, fast punk songs, or even acoustic songs, which I think at this point in their career, they've done all that and then some, you know? But I just thought that was a funny quote, because I love it when a band will like openly admit, oh yeah, we were inspired by that, or oh yeah, we took that, or you know, this other thing over here is what really inspired this. And
I think this is maybe the biggest indication on this record of like where they would end up, you know? Mm-hmm. And so anyone who might've cried sellout or something after this, it's like, well, no, they clearly were into making hookier songs and they weren't shying away from that. I mean, even the first record, you have a song like Ever Changing. Mm-hmm. And so I really think that this is, you know, being a vulnerable lyric and almost sweet sort of sentiment to it. And it's just it's the most accessible song on the record, but it's very much a like precursor to some of the big catchy songs that they would get known for.
Yeah. I mean, lyrically, he's talking about leaving someone behind, maybe, you know, leaving for tour and like leaving, I think I'd read that he was talking like to a daughter or something, but I don't know. I don't know when she was born, but I know he has a daughter, but you know, it could be a girl. He has an immense fondness for this person. Everything you touch turns into gold, and you laugh, creating a lightness in my chest. You know, very, like you said, very vulnerable, very, you know, very sweet lyrics from a band that was just screaming in your ear about societal change.
Yeah. 30 seconds ago.
Yeah.
And yet And yet it doesn't feel out of place
No,
at all.
yeah,
Like
no, it doesn't.
there's something magic about the way they pull this off.
Yeah. I know it doesn't sound forced, it doesn't sound out of place, it doesn't sound weird, you know?
Yeah, and it's like you don't want to skip it when it comes on. You want to sing along.
Hell yeah. I need a little break from all that inward reflection stuff on how the world works.
Yeah, everything is fucked, but within your personal circle, there's these people that mean something to you. It's like,
Yeah.
it's so great. And in terms of like this whole record, so many layers of like how you can look at the world around you, whether it's the big or the immediate, people in your circle. It's just they hit on fucking everything this time.
Yeah, it is a very personal record when you think about it. Songs about losing a friend to, possibly suicide, we're not sure. Having arguments with family members, being affected by what's happening in the world at, just a small level, and then songs like this.
It's got everything.
Yeah. All right, let's close side A with Voices Off Camera.
This is my favorite thing. When I listened to the first like half a dozen of these episodes, and you're talking about albums that came out in the 90s, right? And so like some of them I had on cassettes and whatever. And so I always kind of thought it was funny when you'd be like, all right, now let's turn to side B or whatever, right? And then it wasn't until that many episodes in that I was like, oh, right, these guys collect vinyl. Like I'm born in
It's
85,
Talking
right?
Records,
And
Sam.
so I still buy CDs. I mean, we always called it the record store, but like I still only have CDs. And so when I always thought you were talking about tapes because this is how old they were, but
Talking Tapes is our
I'm just
Patreon only. No, I'm kidding. It's Talking CDs. No.
spinoff. All right. Sorry, sorry. Voices Off Camera.
To me, this song seems to be about a person who's facing a lot of inner turmoil. Can you hear the desperate cries that are calling out your name? Are all the things around this person vying for attention? But this person is like stuck looking within, is missing all the things that are happening around, turning a blind eye to the urgency of other matters that surround. I absolutely love the line, "I can't bear the thought of losing. I dread the attention winning brings." And
Oh,
to me,
yeah.
this suggests being in the middle, just like being kind of stuck between two things, uncertain which way to go.
And that's sort of like fear of failure too, which I think is really common, but you don't always talk about the fear of success, and the self-sabotage that you might on a subconscious level be doing,
Yes,
because it's like
yes.
you're afraid of that change and of that next step,
Yeah, because when something gets really big, you don't have as much control over it. It's not really yours anymore. You've kind of released it out into the ether. I get the sense this person does not want all kinds of focus on them, but he's also like desperate for people to be there, but maybe not the people he's surrounded by. His wisdom for knowing the people around him are not good are stifled by his blindness. And if this life has taught me anything, I forgot it long ago. Just making those mistakes over and over again, that pattern.
a lot of artists and musicians and comedians and creative types will sort of think that like if I do get better, right, my art is my therapy, right, and if I do get better I might lose my edge, I might whatever. And so that's sort of like I don't want to lose, I don't want to see myself as a failure, but at the same time like this is kind of what I know, maybe this is what makes me. Is this defining in some way? Like it's just this dumb artist shit. But I mean, a lot of us think, I think
Oh,
that way.
totally. Oh, yeah. It's more common than you think. The middle section is cool with a distorted vocal overlapping Tim's and then the stop and go bridge part. I love that. They bring back the layered vocal section to finish off the song, and then it ends with just Tim and the guitar, which I think is interesting. Usually you end a fast and hard song with everyone playing, I know these
Yeah,
guys aren't the
it's
first to do
great.
this, but it's still pretty unique to just kind of have a song, whittled down to just a vocal and a guitar.
Yeah, and again, arrangement huge on this record. You talked about the bridge, and I think it's worth noting that almost every song in the record has an amazing bridge that's like the peak of the song.
Yeah.
And this one is 100% built around the vocal. Like, the music is so sparse, it's almost comical. Mm-hmm. Like, fucking Barnes is having to like add these slow little fills in the background just because there's nothing going on, because we are fully on board with Tim right here.
Right.
You know, and like the layering part you talked about, my only critique of this song is that for as busy as the chorus is, we hear it too many times. I think it's interesting what they do with it, you know, the way, okay, we're going to layer it differently and the band stops and we're going to come back and do a full chorus and then we're going to do the little quiet, you know, outro thing. And I think that's rad, but the whole like, hit the grind and I'm still running and I need to play today. It was just like a lot going on. And so I think some of the arrangement could have been applied. Some of those tricks could have been applied to a song with maybe a simpler hook. And maybe they did at a later point, did something more like that to be a little more effective. That's really my only gripe with it. Because what's really cool is if you're listening to this in sequence, the song is almost mirroring the song that came before it. Because instead of having the little alternate string bass line intro, it has a little alternate string guitar intro, right? And it has a fast verse that drops in right away. It has these like inverted drums in the chorus, the de-ba-de-ba-de-ba-de instead of the, you know, and sort of like halfway there, right? And so it's sort of like, okay, we're halfway through the record and we're going to do twists on some of the things that you've heard now.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know. I just think musically it's really interesting. It just one too many repeats at the end or something.
Yeah. All right, Sammy, let's flip this cassette tape over. Side B starts with Blood Red, White and Blue. So bright yourself.
One of my favorite songs.
This is a great
song. Like, first listen.
Yeah.
Woo.
The powers that be had just finished lying to the public and swindled their way into entering what would become the longest war in our country's history, which seeped into songs like Blood Red, White, and Blue. And that's a quote from Tim. Tim also told AP, saying fuck the war in 2002 was different than saying it now and far more dangerous. We were one of the few bands saying it and taking shit accordingly. I wanted a song that talked about the conflict of interest between our God Bless America attitude and our actions that no God would ever bless.
Yeah, and that bridge, oh my God, speaking of like climax of the song, this is, again, that was first listen, one of the parts that just gave me chills though, like, what, God bless the murder of the innocent, and just that whole section, and then ending with this sort of sarcastic, almost tongue-in-cheek God bless America, you know, repeating it, was just like, fuck, that is a pretty brutal criticism, man. Like, if you think about all the shit that Fat Mike took for War on Terrorism and Punk Voter, you know, that same year. But this is in a pre-American Idiot world. And so, you know, it really wasn't the cool thing to do yet, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're not the first to do it, but yeah, you're right. At that time, people were kind of distancing themselves from that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is the same year that, you know, Dixie Chicks get canceled for speaking out, and, you know, Bill Maher's in hot water. And really, like, people got to remember after 9/11, there was this huge sense of, okay, we've got to stand together.
Yes.
And, you know, and figure this out, right? And so even people who wouldn't necessarily be the patriotic people or the people falling in line with the government narrative or whatever, you know, it was still tough to say some of those things at the time.
Well, right. And this was around the time I started to notice that people were really politicizing the flag. I realized this was not like a new thing, but I can remember seeing antagonistic rallies where people would wave American flags as a statement of division. You know, pickup trucks with flags became a challenge to anyone to speak English or, you know, get out of my country. Bumper stickers that said support our troops with the word our underlined, as if having a strong sense of humanitarian sympathy meant you were supporting the enemy. And I just remember being like, what? What's going
yeah,
on?
Yeah. I think it was Lewis Black was talking about, you know, you go to a baseball game or something afterward, and all of a sudden people just start chanting USA, USA, yeah, really aggressively, and be like, hey, that's got a little German on it. Like, careful.
Yeah.
But yeah, dude, this song like is so powerful, and it's structurally similar to Black Mass and Gasoline. So
yeah,
you pointing out that it actually starts side B is very interesting, because it's got the big crashes and guitar blasts, mm-hmm, drops into the solo guitar riff, the fast drums rip into the verses. Like, you know, it's very much a sister song to Black Masks. And I love, 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 I don't want to overlook the chorus of this song too. Just the, it's another one where I love to just sing harmonies over it,
yeah,
in, you know, in my car for fun, you know,
with the windows
so
down.
Pride yourself. Like, oh my God. It's just, it's got the little group shout thing in there too, mm-hmm, you know, and yet it's so fucking catchy and melodic. Like, oh man, this is just the band at its best.
Yeah. And it's the second song on the album, I think, to have a guitar solo. They didn't really do a lot of guitar soloing, but you get this rad guitar solo at the end of the song, which is cool.
Yeah, and I was bummed when I heard that Mr. Precision had left the band after the first record. Mm. But you hear Todd doing some really cool shit that's like kind of unique just to this era of the band. Like, right, they didn't really have a Brian Baker style, you know, guitar solo popping up on other records like this, mm-hmm, you know?
Yeah, it's true. All right, let's move on to Broken English. A song about looking around at the crumbling buildings and the sad state of affairs our world is often stuck in. We can't comprehend the sad state that we're in. This is often the feelings people have after a tragedy or something like that. Of course, the song written after 9/11, it's easy to assume it could be about that tragedy, but I'm sure they're not speaking about, like, you know, one isolated incident.
Yeah, I mean, the cool thing about Rise Against is that they're not, say, specific as a Dead Kennedy song or something that's like about,
right,
an event. You know, they're generally going to kind of use a situation to almost kind of just be an all encapsulating like metaphor for, you know, something bigger. And so I think that's what's cool about, I've heard people criticize, you know, political punk of being like, oh, it's just like fucking generic, you know, fuck the government shit, or it's just,
yeah,
what's cool about it is what they don't like about it. Because if you can get your own meaning from what they're talking about, then that's sometimes more powerful than giving you the history lesson breakdown. And as a person who's written both types of songs, I love doing the deep dive historical context shit, but sometimes it's more just about, you know, the emotion and what, how you feel about it, you know, and what you can take from it. So
yeah,
they're very good at that.
Yeah, they are. You know, it gets you thinking, because when I hear this song, I think a lot about, you know, like terrorist attacks and, you know, why a person or group would inflict such unspeakable damage and harm on others. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, in the news lately, we've had all these shootings. In this country, many have turned their backs on people struggling with mental health. I read, according to the American Psychological Association, that national statistics indicate that one in every five teens has some type of mental health problem in any given year. The problems range from mild to severe. And unfortunately, most young people with mental health struggles don't receive proper treatment. You know, if you broke your leg and or came down with the flu, you wouldn't go untreated. Often, young people just ignore those health problems, thinking they'll, you know, snap out of it, or, you know, or that it's something to be ashamed of and they shouldn't tell
it's a anybody. Phase.
Yeah,
you know?
Or it's a phase.
It's a phase. You'll grow out of it, you know. And that's something that I've been wrestling with, too. I was just saying after the Uvalde shooting, if we had, let's say, passed, you know, certain gun laws and and restrictions and regulations after Columbine or Thurston High School, which happened across town from me a year before that. You know, if we had really cracked down and done everything like, you know, Australia or some of these other countries had done, right? I think that only now would we really be thinking, man, remember when that shit used to happen all the time? Mm-hmm. Like, it's been a little while now, huh? Because I really think that because of mental health and because of policing, because of so many of these other issues, that it's probably going to take a generation to weed shit out, you know. Yeah. It really would. But yeah, it's crazy how multifaceted these things are. And so again, like, when you write about it, how specific do you want to be in order to have your listener actually, you know, feel something with you and want to carry that? Because they're a band that wants to inspire you.
Yeah.
They want you to walk away feeling like, yeah, let's do something. Like Anna Flag or something.
Yeah. I mean, I just wish that this nation would spend more money on social uplift and, you know, I don't know. Yeah, the Department of Defense, I think like the 2020 Department of Defense was like $740 billion or something like that.
Yeah. It's outrageous. Yeah. When people are always like, oh, we got to cut schools, we got to cut this, we got to cut that. Yeah. And then it's like, look at the pie chart, guys. Look at the pie chart. Yeah. It's insane.
It's crazy.
I want to talk about the music on this song, though, because it's a nice deviation. Like, it comes in with almost this Good Riddance style riff and then played at a faster tempo. We talk about Todd. He's doing this almost Billy Joe style melodic lead that would have been at home in a more mid-tempo song or something, but he's kind of playing it extra fast. I thought that was a really cool, like, textural guitar layer that they don't really do. And then this chorus has a trick that Rise Against has actually, I would say, run into the ground. They've used it so much. But this is the first example I can think of where they come out of the verse or the pre-chorus and they do a beat drop. And the vocal does a pick up into the chorus. So it goes, dent, and we get right back up again. You know,
again.
So when the band comes back in.
It's funny.
And I remember I'd gotten out of them for a few years. And my mom starts getting into them when they're like big on the radio now. Like, you might like the new one. Yeah. It's pretty good.
Have you heard of the Rise Against?
Like, oh, fine, mom. Fine. Play me the Rise Against. You know, so she's playing me this song that I'd never heard before. I'm sitting on her couch. It's like the arrangement's going. I'm like, okay, well, it's going to drop down dynamically in the verse. Yep. And so I did that. And then, okay, guess what? They're ramping up a little bit. And I went like this, like, they're going to stop. And they stop. Yeah. And I fucking, like, clap my hands. And he's going to, and then bam, and they're back in. And like, that's just how they did choruses for a while.
Yeah.
And
that's interesting.
This is the first time I heard him do it. And like, you can see why, because it's, I mean, have you ever heard that part of this song and not sung along with it? Like, it's very effective.
You gotta.
I mean, I don't fault them for doing it a lot, but this is a turning point in their bag of tricks.
Yeah, speaking of bag of tricks, Tim told AP that, you know, they don't do a lot of soloing, but he wrote, he said, I love Todd's solo on this one. Todd and I had found a guitar tab book for Appetite for Destruction in the dumpster behind our work, and it quickly became our, like, coffee table piece. Some of that gritty rock stank ended up in little flourishes in Todd's playing. And I just think that's so interesting.
Yeah, influences you wouldn't think of. And, you know, when you talk about a guitar tab book, I think about, you know, all the struggles of trying to learn those songs when you're a kid and they don't make sense.
Mm-hmm. The next song is Last Chance Blueprint.
This song's funny to me because it's always been one of my favorites. And yet I'm always a, like, sit and listen to the full album front to back guy.
Yeah.
And so when I was, like, taking my notes, I'm looking at the titles on the back just to build a template. I'm like, Last Chance Blueprint. What the fuck song is that? Like, I didn't even know the name all these years. But yeah, it opens with those, or one of two American Beauty samples, which, you know, having been 13 or 14 years old in 1999 when that movie came out, you know, like that and Fight Club, you know, like those are like my favorite movies, and so I loved hearing that.
Well, I remember being psyched that I actually recognized it. Like most of those like movie quotes that bands were throwing on their albums back then, that were just like from obscure, you know, weird movies and stuff. Yeah. This one, I was like, "Hey, that's from American Beauty."
Yeah, yeah,
that's the movie with the bag that's blowing around in the wind.
It's got that sort of almost Fugazi intro.
Yeah,
that's kind of neat. That's like gradual, like fade in behind the sample, mm-hmm. and it sort of like pushes the upper end of their mid tempo songs, but it sort of sits in its own place, like the pace of this song. It's really neat.
Yeah, I wouldn't listen to the demo, which doesn't have the dialogue. Because when I hear the dialogue, I always listen to the dialogue. My ear just pulls me that way. But I listened to the demo just to hear that part. I was like, oh, you know, this is kind of cool.
Yeah, and this is another one that's just so passionate, so singable. It's maybe the best example of Tim's voice and like his growth from the first album to this one. Like his rasp mm-hmm. is absolutely perfect. Like he just sort of vacillates between singing and screaming so seamlessly mm-hmm. in this. Mm-hmm. That it's just an amazing performance. Like as somebody who's been like a punk and hardcore singer my whole life, this song is an amazing vocal performance.
Yeah, that's awesome. And of course, I'm a very light spoken person. If I scream in one song, my voice is gone for a month. But I'm always impressed by people who can do that. And yeah, this is just a great song, a song about breaking away, getting out, leaving. He sings, "One last chance to go. If I don't leave tonight, I never will." You know, it's like, you got to do it. You got to push yourself to get out, because if you don't, you're just gonna be stuck.
And there's a couple examples of like Blood Red, White and Blue, "So Pride Yourself," you know, like those big long notes in those choruses. This is another one where it's just so fucking, oh, it just gets me every time.
Yeah, I get the sense that in the song Tim is speaking about having goals or dreams, and that the only way he can achieve them is to kind of bust out of his current situation. But of course it's not that easy. There's always something to stall or delay that action. So I feel like sometimes you just have to like cut and run, you know, just like drop out and like go do your thing. Because if you are trying to find the right time, it'll never be the right time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's the right time is kind of when you get the courage to do it. You know, it's kind of mirrors the sentiment of like a Les and Jake song, you know, like Al's War, the closer on Hello Rock View, or Escape from the A-Bomb House on Anthem, you know, like songs like that are really... Again, how they go back and forth from big political, social commentary, thematic stuff to these really personal moments is just so impressive. You know, the way the song just fucking drops in, it has such an urgency the whole time.
Yeah.
I couldn't say enough good things. I would ramble to tell you more superlatives about
it. Well, I want to like grab onto that and say, so to continue various themes on this record, the next song is about internet hate. So... To the Core. A song best summed up by the line, "Time spent on hate is time gone to waste. I watch you point and click your life away." And Tim had told AP at the time, message boards were becoming more common and people anonymously expressing opinions without being held accountable for what they were saying. That was becoming the norm. The internet, a creation meant to foster dialogue and creativity, was being used to basically just talk shit and rile people up.
And this is really ahead of its time, because you got to think, this song existing in the age of like primitive message boards, you know, this is way before social media, guys.
Right,
and so, you know, this is a song that is so much more relevant today than it ever was when it was written. And it's just so ferocious. Like it's probably the most just straight up hardcore banger on the whole record.
Yeah.
And got that sick of it all bass break, you know, and it's just fucking, it's just gnarly. Like at some point, I will have to play this song. It's just that good.
Yeah, this is just a ripping song, and just, you know, a song that is really easy to relate to, because, you know, we all use the internet and we've all maybe been on the receiving end of, you know, someone posting something that they would never say to your face, you know?
Yeah.
And just hiding behind posts, spewing anger and hate. of course, from the safety of their own homes and offices, you know, never daring to actually say these types of things to people. Well, I mean, some do, but yeah, you know, internet trolling is just a huge form of cowardice. You know, it's like the things people put in print next to their like goofy profile pictures. It's like you read it and you're like, what?
Yeah. Or if you go down through like somebody's, let's say a page with a big following and you see, you know, there's a bunch of negative comments mixed in there, right? And you click on all of them, they got fucking zero posts and no profile picture. Yeah. They're just a fucking fake account just so they trolls. Can talk shit.
Yeah.
You know, and at, like, as a person with OCD and anxiety, like, it's just a horrible combination because yeah. I am always prone to read the comments. Mm-hmm. I'm always prone to think of, like, why would you say this?
Yeah.
And, you know, just the conflict of the whole thing. I can never stay out of the comments section, but I fucking hate it there. It's what it's like a double-edged
sword. It's like
you
can't not go in.
Yeah.
But you always regret it.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, the next song is Torches.
Where did my head go?
I love how Todd's palm eating those verses so that when the quick moving and opened up power chords in the chorus come in, it like really gives it some power, you know?
The shift there is huge. Like they don't just ramp up into the vocal when they go into the chorus in this, which is what they always do.
Yeah.
You get those huge chords, da 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 da. Like it really is like it's like a palate cleanser kind of going into it. It's really, really cool. And just in terms of guitar playing, the opening riff, it's almost a classic rock guitar part that's just played really fast.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you mentioned that GNR thing. Like, I wonder if that was one of the influences here because it's a really cool melodic chord thing that they're doing.
I bet. Yeah, I bet it was. And we got to talk about this bridge, man. This hardcore breakdown. It's great screamy part.
Yeah. Yeah, it's another one of those, like, I'm also a huge sucker for a false ending. You know, and so to like go through this huge thing, like this song is super dynamic and we're ramping up and ramping up, you know, it's like the bridge singing and then screaming.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we cut out and it's over and then it comes back in with the da 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 da. Like, it's just. Oh,
you're
man,
like, yes.
It's so good. Yeah, it's one of those fucking roller coaster songs where, you know, you're like happy with where it ended up, but then you get the fucking like post credit scene and you're like, ah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the stinger. Fucking sprinkles on top, man. It's so good. Like, it's like every song on this album has the same DNA. Like, you could tell it wasn't just a batch of songs thrown together. You know, it was like they sat down with a vision for the record and sort of like.
Totally.
It's not one of those where you could, you know, every song just sounds the same. It's like, I don't know. They just sound so inspired on every single song to be making all these little tiny choices.
Sure.
Yeah. That each pay off, you know. And again, I just listen to the whole thing, you know, front to back all the time. But when you really analyze song by song, it's like, oh, man, they are having a blast constructing these fucking songs. Yeah. Like you could just
and
tell,
collaborating, you know? You can tell there's a lot of different voices in there.
Yeah But again, like that fucking that it's like the halfway there, they're like build.
Yeah.
And instead of giving it to you, they just go silent.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's the most effective thing, you know.
He even talks about the music slowing down in that vocal, in that lyric part.
Yeah, the music slows down and each one slowly dons their wings. Once that's out, they all pair off. Yeah, right. Totally.
Isn't that crazy?
Totally.
Let's go into the last song, Amber Changing. This is a nice rip and closer. It's a great finish to a great album. The verses are kind of slower, almost like a rock tempo, and then the choruses pick up, you know? They do that well.
And again, it's got that like starts like track two, it's got the like ripping fast drums,
yeah.
Right, but
here we go,
but it's got just four chords ringing out,
yeah,
you know, like it's sort of I don't know, I like when it's almost like a first track on Ballads for the Revolution,
yeah,
from Good Riddance, where it's like crazy intense drums, but like they're just kind of hinting at the guitars and letting it kind of build up, but when they fucking pull that emergency brake, and drop down into the palm muted guitar thing, man. Like that is so cool.
Yeah.
And there's just so much space for Tim to do his thing, and probably the most since that really sparse bridge that we talked about on voices.
Yeah.
where you're just like narrowed in on Tim's vocal there.
Yeah. I'm not really sure what the song's about. I mean, I've heard people say that it's like something you wrote about being at a show, or like a punk show or something, but I don't know, man. I poured over this one. I was like, I don't really know what this is about.
Yeah, I mean, you can get that feeling from the chorus of the song that it's almost like a thank you for playing the way you play sort of thing.
Definitely.
But I heard on a previous episode of Talking Records that I think it was Rory from No Use said Tony Sly's rule when building like really fast riffs and pushing the tempos on a song was that he would use a slower vocal cadence.
Yes, yeah.
And I pointed out a couple of good choruses like that, but this is maybe the best. The no place that I'd rather be. Yeah. And just those long sustained notes that you want to sing with the fucking ripping ass drums behind it. Like, it's so effective. And it made me think about, I was like, oh, I'm going to think about some of the faster songs on my new record. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, that's why that song, that's why that one has got such a good chorus. That's fun to sing. Because it's that juxtaposition of the like really legato part with the fucking insanely fast like machine gun fire music behind it. Like,
yeah,
it's
a great tactic.
When you're that young and you're a new band, like I don't even know if they're aware that they're doing it, but there's like three or four songs where they fucking just drive it home like that.
Yeah, and I wonder if that comes from like being on tour and watching other bands and just kind of picking up tips, talking to other songwriters, you know, stuff like that.
There's a certain point of experience where you start to become aware of all these things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's like there's a certain innocent period there where you're just trying shit.
Yeah.
And I think this record is more of a just trying shit. And, you know, it's not till later that they started to feel a little more formulaic to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's so much DNA in this album that spread to the later records, and that's definitely one of the things too.
Very cool. All right, well, that wraps up the record.
Does it though? I mean, I know you have the vinyl.
See,
but the original,
I've got the
release
vinyl. I forgot.
See,
about the journey,
the original release. Yeah, but Tim's saying that them being a fairly young band at that point and trying to engage their audience, throwing in the hardcore covers, and then the quote being like, it's something like, we play a Black Flag song and even the kids in the Black Flag shirts don't recognize the song.
Right.
And so we joked, well, shit, we might as well cover Journey or something.
Yeah,
like
the minute
that
they crank up Journey, everyone's like, oh, yeah, man.
The trivia on this song, though, is that the drums are alternating takes cut together of Barnes and Bill and Jason.
Oh.
And so if you listen to it, there's a completely different swing on the verses, which to me sounds like Bill, and the choruses are more driving, like right on the fucking metronome.
Yep.
And so it's really interesting if you listen to the drums on this, because it's actually all three of them. And Jason confirmed that this week when I asked him.
Well, that gives me an excuse to listen to the song. You want to know how many times I've heard their cover of Journey?
Once?
Maybe once or twice.
Yeah. I mean, when I was... okay, again, in high school when this came out, and I'm like, you know, it's like my mom's favorite band from the 80s. It's my favorite band right now. Hey, listen to this. And she's like, yeah, I don't know. That's kind of that's weird. That's different, right?
Yeah.
And then again, like 10 years later, she's going, have you heard the new Rise Against?
Yeah. You're like, I don't know, but have you heard this old Journey record I found?
A couple of the songs recorded at this time that are notable songs for the band. Generation Lost.
Oh yeah, I was on the comp, yeah.
Give It All. That was also on a comp. And Swing Life Away, apparently, they did the sort of Good Riddance Time of Your Life thing that Green Day did, where it's like, oh, you know, that's from Dookie, but it showed up on Nimrod.
Yeah.
Like, they wrote Swing Life Away on this record.
I didn't know that
until last week.
Wow.
Yeah. And so three really, really good songs came from this same era that kind of propelled the band forward into
awesome
their next record,
hold on to them, yeah.
Siren Song. Yeah, pretty neat.
Pretty cool. Taking a look at the cover art for Revolutions Per Minute, it's got this grenade. It's got like headphones stuck into it. I guess Mike Jackson had this idea and the band just loved it, you know, with the print and everything, the grenade. And, you know, my takeaway from that is they must have been like, hey, we got Michael Jackson to do our cover. Oh, but not that Michael Jackson.
I didn't really know much about the artwork other than it's just an instantly recognizable sort of,
yeah,
like a lot of album covers you got to look at and I don't know what it means or whatever, you right. know.
Like, this is like, pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah. Like I've had 40 Ounce of Freedom for like 25 years and only this year did I actually realize that the waves on the outline of the sun are sperm going in to fertilize the egg. Yeah. Like
that was an old high school
thing.
That's
how many years it took me to figure that out, right? Versus this one, you just look at it and you're like, oh yeah, this is a banger.
Oh yeah. Explosive music. Got it.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's not much else to it. There's a cool photo of the band sitting on the steps on the back. They've got the tracks listed on the back, which is, you know, it's pretty sparse, but, you know, sometimes a sparse cover is better than one that's too busy, you know?
And on the CD, there's nothing on the back but the tracks. It's just that fucking, like, spray paint gradient effect and the tracks going down it, and then the insert is what has the band photo on it. Cool. So it's like, it's very plain, straightforward of like, you know what guys, just listen to the fucking songs,
yeah.
You know?
In closing, Rise Against followed up their debut with a solid record. If The Unraveling was the band testing the waters or introducing themselves, Revolutions was a statement of the band's longevity and commitment to making music. Enlisting the fine folks at the Blasting Room was a remarkable choice, as Bill and Jason were able to understand what the band wanted to do and help them get there. In the early 2000s, I was a huge fan of this band. I love the cross between the screaming and singing and the fast and hard tempos. Bands like this and Good Riddance and Bad Religion encouraged me to try to write a bit more about my surroundings for my own band. Revolutions Per Minute remains my favorite Rise Against album, though they have a lot of other great albums. None of them seem to hit me the way this one did. The ferocity, the pace, were exactly what I was looking for at the time to make sense of my own feelings. You know, feelings of being 23 and interacting with the world much differently than when I was in school, and my world seemed a lot smaller.
It's not one of those records, like I said, where it's a bunch of songs thrown together, or a band writes 20 songs and whittles it down to the best 12 or something like that. Again, they just sound so inspired. Every song, like lyrically, structurally, melodically, and the production being such a huge step up. Like, you know, they've got, I think, 10 full-length albums now, plus the B-sides record. A testament to the longevity, but I know a lot of friends that stopped listening, you know, after these first like 2, 3, 4 records, because not because they were on a major label, but just because they sounded so fucking hungry. You know, like back then, those records are just, there's an urgency. The best songs are the ones that need to be written. You know, like there are a lot of musicians who, you know, they'll sit down as like an exercise or like practice, like, okay, I have to try to write a song a day, or I have to whatever, or we have to get this number of songs for the album or something like that. And for me, it was never that. I only pick up my instrument if I have to get something off my chest. You know, I only sit down to write lyrics when I really have to say something. And it could be something I've been mulling over in my head for 2 years. And I finally have the, this is how I'm going to say it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I don't have shitloads of B-sides and things that never made it. It's like when an album is done, you know, it means I'm laying out all the songs in an order and going, oh, they almost fit together, and I guess I gotta wait a little longer. Then you get a couple more songs and you're feeling, oh shit, yeah, that's it, right, perfect, yeah. Right, you just know when you're done, when the songs need to be said. And so this record in particular, you can tell every song is felt on the most deep and primal level. It's just passion front to back. So to me, that's why it's the standout forever. And I, you know, I love all their records in their own way, but man, this is timeless.
Well, Sammy Warm Hands, I would like to thank you so much for hanging out with me today and talking about this record. I had a blast, man. Your insights into the music were just great. I this was fun. I had a good time.
Oh, thank you, man. I feel like it's a real privilege to get to come on. Like I said, I mean, I'm really glad to be here, and I'd be happy to do another someday.
So. Very cool. Absolutely. All right. I would like to thank my man, Craig, for really being into this kind of music, loud and screamy stuff. And I guess by osmosis, turning me onto it. I'd like to thank Chris DeMakes from Less Than Jake for the theme music. And of course, I would like to thank all of you for tuning into Talking Records. It's a blast to dive into these fantastic records, chat about the songs, and try to gather up all the information we can into one neat little podcast. Check us out on the socials, say hello, suggest albums, tell us your stories. How did you get into Rise Against? Make sure you check out the Take 92 podcast, and definitely check out Sammy's band, Dead Fucking Serious.
Yes, and you know, give this podcast the 5-star rating and review like I did.
That's awesome. All right, everybody, take care.